Oh, it's a distinct pleasure for me to appear this evening. I had some doubt myself earlier this evening whether I would ever get here. The distance between the airport and the lights and this building seems to be greater than the distance between Cleveland and St. Louis. But I had a feeling of the evening prior that we were coming to some sort of British intelligence unit. And that I never could find my way out of it, no matter if I even equipped with a car. Yes, I must admit to being primarily a clinical neurosurgeon. It's true that I'm responsible for a large research laboratory that directly suffers toward investigation of the nervous system. With my own day in and day out activities, I do teaching neurosurgery as much of an author as a client, and to operate and take care of patients myself. So I not only welcome the opportunity to give you a short resume of my own feelings regarding to the problems of death as a physician, but to listen very carefully to the other presentations that I will follow, because there's no question that this is a major problem in medicine today. Recently, it has been recommended that the time-honored clinical definition of death be redefined in terms of the central nervous system performance, specifically the demonstrated absence of brain activity. Practically, the demise of the human organism has always been associated with the cessation of cardiac and respiratory activity. And until recently, this presented no serious problem to the physician, lawyer, or theologian. However, because of the mega advances characterizing biomedical research of the last two decades, most notably in the fields of organ transplantation and the prolongation of life, the traditional concept of clinical or medical death is being challenged. There is no question that the practicalities and the necessities of organ transplantation, in particular, have accelerated the re-examination of this definition, and thereby shown in the sharp focus the scientific conclusion which attends the transition of an individual from life to death. Critical to the problem of scientifically defining death in the practical terms is the knowledge that technology has now provided us with mechanical and pharmacological support systems, which can substitute for many of the vital processes, including cardiorespiratory function, by taking over, as it were, the workloads of entire organ systems. As presently developed, some of these machines can be employed only for short periods of time. For example, total extracorporeal circulatory control, utilizing an artificial heart. However, there is every reason to believe that eventually the engineering problems associated with these devices will be overcome, permitting chronic implantation. Thus, we have to acknowledge the probability that eventually all of the major cellular complexes of the human body will be replaceable either by transplanted organs, human or animal, or sophisticated engineering modules. So admittedly, the expense and logistics of such an undertaking will and would be enormous. But we must admit to these possibilities if we are to examine human death from an objective point of view, since the anatomical structures which formally form the biological basis for the definition of death are acknowledged to be replaceable by mere mechanical elements. Pew, in a recent article, echoes the concern of many physicians in this country when he writes, quote, "There has been increasing concern regarding medical as well as social and economic justification of using extraordinary means to maintain artificially vegetative function of a fatally injured person. It appears, therefore, that a redefinition of death based on the integrity of the central nervous system has become possible for at least two reasons. One, to reduce the suffering of the patient, his family, and the burden of the hospital bed and the staff, and second, to make available organs of such patients for transplantation. End of quotation. Here again, this writer stresses the practicality of shifting the clinical definition of death from the cardiopulmonary to the central nervous system. But why is medical science placing such emphasis on this particular system to the exclusion of all others? Because this system is not replicatable, representing as it does the repository of the highest functions of man. The human brain provides the tissue substrate for intelligence, memory, behavior, emotion, yes, even personality. Within the interstices of this organ, the most complex structure known, resides those unique factors that characterize us as human beings and as particular individuals. It could be argued that all organ transplantation and organ engineering replication and substitution is directed towards sustaining the performance of this single organ, the human brain. Conversely, in this elite cellular system fails, it would seem reasonable to assume that what is characteristically human is also being lost from the body. Many physicians, particularly in this country, are now equating clinical death in a patient with brain death. This new concept was given considerable emphasis with a publication in 1968 as a report of the ad hoc committee of the Harvard Medical School, which stated, quote, our primary purpose was to define irreversible coma as the new criterion for death, end of quote. While numerous sets of regulations have now been promulgated for the definition of a permanently non-functioning brain by other groups, the characteristics of irreversible coma laid down by the Harvard Committee have enjoyed the most universal acceptance. In general, they are as follows. One, unreceptivity and unresponsiveness. Second, no movement or breathing. Three, no reflexes. And four, a flat electroencephalogram. All of the above tests must be repeated at least 24 hours later without showing any change, and by that any improvement. If these clinical and electroencephalographic conditions are existent for the period stated, that is 24 hours, there appears to be little reason to argue the irreversibility of the cerebral function. For in 1969, the American Electroencephalographic Society reported that of 1,665 patients presenting with isoelectric electroencephalogram and meeting the above neurological criteria, only 3 patients recovered some cerebral function, and these had been in coma from drug intoxication. It has been recognized for some time that great care must be utilized in applying the above criteria for brain death in patients known to be suffering from drug intoxication or in a state of hypothermia. Recently, Pugh has questioned the need for an absolutely flat electroencephalographic tracer, particularly in those cases where the neurosurgeon has operated on the brain and recognize the extent of tissue damage. Our experience, now quite extensive, is similar to Pugh's, in that of surgery, the brain may show evidence of overwhelming destruction, totally incompatible with survival. And yet, during the early post-operative period, electrocortical activity and spinal reflexes could be obtained. Thus, the brain may be incapable of recovery even when it does not meet all of the clinical and electroencephalographic limitations imposed by the new definition of brain death. An additional shortcoming in the present proposal for defining brain death is a universal requirement for repeated examination over a lengthy time interval. As a consequence, the problem has arisen, particularly with reference to securing organs for transplantation under excellent physiological conditions, as making an absolute judgment of brain death immediately, or at least within a relatively short period of time, which cannot be satisfied by the present criteria. To assist in more scientifically defining brain death, Shalet and et al. Have investigated the blood flow and oxygen consumption of the dying brain. They found that when the cerebral oxygen consumption fell below one-third of normal value, brain death was manifested by classical clinical signs. Their study, which attempts to biochemically define brain failure and death, add an entirely new and significant dimension to the definition of this state. Unfortunately, like the traditional neurological and electrical examination, they emphasize the need for repeated sampling of arterial and jugular venous blood in order to measure cerebral metabolism over an extended period of time. Our own biochemical studies of metabolism in the failing brain demonstrate a gradual reduction in oxygen consumption, but still present right up to the moment of total physiological collapse of the brain. It is evident then that even with the additional parameters of cerebral metabolic measurement and the calculation of cerebral blood flow, a period of time during which the examinations are repetitively performed is required to absolutely establish brain death, as obviously indicated by the demonstration of non-functioning persistence or no improvement in the abnormal measurement. Presumably, the proof of the correctness of all of these protocols for documenting brain death is that the cerebral performance does not improve, and the patient is incapable of survival without the employment of extraordinary means to support vital body processes. Obviously, then, the scientific limitations of brain death, as presently conceived, are time dependent. If we wish to define irreversibility of brain death acutely, then the advantage of time, with its multiple studies, would be lost and would require an absoluteness of methodology and definition which are not yet available in the programs which have been described and implemented, at least in this country. In all probability, the scientific limitations of such a definition would require direct examination of brain tissue, employing both biochemistry and neurophysiology to assess the actual state of performance of the brain tissue to assure irreversibility. While this would require invasive techniques, particularly operative, they could be accomplished through small trepanations of the skull, which offer little or no danger to the patient. Employing standardized equipment, biopsies of brain tissue would be obtained for direct chemical analysis, and a small series of stereotactically oriented depth electrodes would be placed in major subcortical areas of the brain. In this way, the tissue matrix of the brain could be examined directly, hopefully providing a profile from which present and future tissue irreversibility could be argued with a high degree of certainty. Fortunately, considerable research has been done on the biochemical failure of the brain in the experimental animal during the process of dying, demonstrating the expected lactate as well as other metabolite accumulation, in addition, substrate exhaustion. that meaningful comparison could be made between the animal data and that obtained in humans in defining the biochemical profile of the saline brain. Less information is available referable to surface and depth EEG recordings in the agonal state. Nevertheless, sampling of the deep system, particularly the reticular activating system and other appropriate sites following evoked stimulation, would assist significantly in defining brain death neurophysiologically. We simply do not understand the evolving pathophysiology of cerebral fluid, which is rendered highly complex since the brain is actually composed of many cellular systems performing specific functions and yet intimately associated with the entire brain organ. Each of these tissue substrates has its own metabolic rate and actually fails as a functioning cellular aggregate at its own unique time constant. Thus, it must be admitted that brain death as presently defined is a generalization, indicating failure of gross performance and, more importantly, overall organization, since numerous subsystems within the brain are still viable and functioning. It should be remembered also that the entire brain of the subhuman primate can be removed from its body and maintained in a high performance state for hours, supported exclusively by machinery. In addition, the brain in the same animal can be transplanted and maintained as a unique energy unto itself for many days. Likewise, small cell aggregates from brain can be grown into sequences, and skin slices of cerebral tissue can actively respire for hours in appropriate nutrient fluid. Even if the integrity of removed brain cells is destroyed by such a technique, and the various resulting cellular fractions, for instance, mitochondria, are examined, they are capable of taking up oxygen for hours. Thus, one should appreciate that we have the same difficulty in pronouncing the problem of cellular death in the brain as we have in other organs. What particularly disturbing in this context is the knowledge that large portions of the human brain can be physically acquired with retention of normal or near normal cerebral functions, and that infants are born daily displaying awake patterns, excellent movement, and reflex activity, but actually having only the most rudimentary portions of brain in the cranial cavity. We have much to learn referable to the phenomena of brain failure and brain death before we can construct with certainty the scientific limits of this definition, particularly if the decision is to be rendered immediately or over a minimum time span. After all, like all biological activities, life and death merge into one another, representing a continuum. And the neuroscientist can only, in the final analysis, determine the point of irreversibility of this highly complex system, at which the possibility of organized activity that characterizes human behavior has been exceeded. Thank you.
To stand up here and field the questions, comments, responses from the group.
Sure. Jade emphasizes the present set of rules that have been promulgated seem to fit the situation fairly well and are actually implementable in almost any hospital. The problem that we are under, particularly in medical centers, is to move this definition in closer, not 24 hours out, but to move it in either in a sense of making it an immediate decision or over a relatively short period of time. Now, it is my contention that the present rules that I set up are time dependent and would be simply incompletely adequate to define this case for over a matter of several hours. There are certain universities, particularly where cardiac transplantation was a growing concern in this country, in which these definitions were made in a matter of a few hours. And for a number of us who have actually spent some time investigating brain failure in the animal, have felt that unless one goes to the organ itself, biochemically or neurophysiologically, that unless you're willing to grasp it, this invasive technique, then we feel at the moment it's going to be extremely hard to make those definitions within an hour or two of the patient arriving, say, from the field of heading. The one loophole that she has pointed out, and our own work substantiates it, is that if the patient arrives and requires intracranial surgery, it's possible under those circumstances, without doing any biopsy, the cranial surgeon simply knows that this organ is incapable of doing anything, and that with the proper instrumentation and support, they can go on for several days or several weeks. But he knows, especially while this patient goes nowhere. Now, my argument is that I think we're going to be, within the next decade or two, requested to make these diagnoses of death. Not over a 24-hour span, but over a matter of a few hours. Now, this is it. But as two points out, even that is not incredible. And I would say that, and I don't really pretend or make any pretense of being an electroencephalographer, but one of the more difficult things or even a trained encephalographer is to make the decision that the tracing is truly flat. And unfortunately, it's very hard to escape the use of this particular instrument. But be it as it may, even in some medical centers where they have many of these instruments and highly trained people, this is often a debate. So to get around that, the Harvard group at any rate, argued for 25, but there you are, you're about for 6 hours and you're still finding the same error. And there may be some dangers in that. Yeah, can I afford it? Let me take some care. Well, if we're talking about a patient, let's say he has a brain tumor, and we operate on it, and we find out that it's highly malignant, and we do as large a decompression as we possibly can, and we talk in terms of x-rays. In that situation, we're talking to a patient who still has the properties of information processing. I rely very heavily on the relatives. In discussing with them, if they are very adamant about the patient being told his exact condition, that it's malignant and only has a short period of time or so to live, I'm frankly concerned about abrogating, even though it's patient's own life and his own brain, abrogating the opinions of the patient as well. Of course, the other situation is the patient who has, say, been rendered so damaged from a car accident, he's not the problem of the relative. Then I find, when you're talking to the second or third, time, is that then we paint a very, very bad picture. In fact, I paint a bad picture even if there is some chance that things will improve, because they, so frequently we can't make a judgment of the total success of an individual, even at the present time. So I always support the relatives, let's say, in a individual who's been seriously damaged, brainwashed, and acted. But the situation is going to be tough and dry, and they must face up to the fact the patient's going to pass away. But from somebody who at one time thought, and indeed was taught, about the responsibility of informing the patient about its condition if he can be informed, you know, sometimes in neurosurgery that's less of a problem than it is some other healthy system. I must admit that, and I think of a recent an American Airlines executive who had a head of malignant tumor which required the operation twice. And, you know, he's kind of saying he simply died inside of a year, but he was still able to get around all the time. But really wasn't possible for me to elaborate and describe to him that he had a malignant condition. It was very difficult. Yeah. Well, I think it's wrong, really, for the physician to interpose the nursing staff, social workers, and other such people to handle it. But I think that if you're going to do this sort of thing, you should be use all of these sort of paramedical facilities. But I think above all, the physician has to know the family and the individual well enough. So that he can set about, which I think is an important factor of the whole management, he can set about a program that he thinks offers that consolation, if you like, and assurance to the patient himself. What I'm really saying is I can't bring myself to tell another individual that you have a cancer of the brain which is going to carry you away in the coma in a matter of a few months. I simply am unable to do that. Now, if I feel that there are, frankly, economic and social aspects, say a man who has several small children as well, and I do everything possible in discussing this with his wife to at least get her agreement about the sort of situation, that he has to be told that he has, say, a malignant lesion, and that it's important to him to make whatever insurance and property settlements are necessary. But it's extremely difficult, unless there are other factors here, to go to somebody and, in a sense, be perfectly honest. It doesn't follow in their surgery that perhaps he does in other things, is, you know, you're always being told about somebody who has been operated on for cancer, and the physicians are convinced that it wasn't totally removed, and that he's going to die within 6 months, and they're told the family. And he doesn't die in 6 months. He lives for a year or two, or something of this order. In other words, the time frame gets out of sight. So you don't usually face that problem so much in neurosurgery. Usually what's going to happen is going to happen, and it happens at a fairly fast. I seem to be sort of beating around the bush there, but I can tell you it's a problem for me, as I'm sure it is for you in your position, yes, sir. Well, I think that's true. However, I must again admit that the probabilities that are simply around in neurosurgery are simply so high and so well known and so relatively overwhelming in terms of the possibility for somebody having a high grade malignancy of brain and surviving, being cured, or not even reported. Well, you see, there are two problems, aren't there? I mean, you're taking a patient, and these examinations that I mentioned really are. I set up the standard methodology that is approved and used by physicians. Well, first of all, it's really a clinical examination that's required. A clinical examination, and this is really basically a neurological examination, in which they want to demonstrate that by stimulating the patient really in the most violent and painful way, there's actually no response. And the most primitive responses that you'd expect are abstinence patients. In addition, a series of reflex examinations are carried out All these various things by comparing them against what's already been done with salmon and animals, may lead you to believe that biochemically, the brain has no capability of restoring self attention. The other feature, which, as I mentioned, is not as well worked out, is that you have to make openings in the skull to obtain these small portions of tissue. And let me assure you, this is not a major problem and would not be a hindrance to the finding. You can slip in, as he's done in patients who have no problem in terms of dying, but have epilepsy or other difficulties, a series of electrodes which can be very easily targeted into the depth of the brain using stereotactic methodology. But in these circumstances, you could examine the subcortical centers, which are again more primitive, and might indeed evidence some electrical activity, or the absence of it. This would be a much better criteria than just the surface recording by itself. So what I'm arguing is that if you, or if the public, and say the scientific community, wishes, and finds it necessary to make these judgments in a much greater period of time, then we must go after a tissue examination in order to feel safe and confident. That's really the argument. It's just that we're saying, and the examples I gave not only wrong about the truth, but that these are not adequate enough. That's it. Now, I think that's a very good question. With the small reduction in the need for cardiac organ availability, since there's really almost a moratorium that's in place on cardiac transplantation, perhaps the rush that was taken 2 or 3 years ago isn't taken any longer. Well, there is nothing to say. But as time goes on, the organs in which removal doom the patient to death, the example would be heart versus kidney, we're going to require again the introduction of some methodology superior to what is now currently available. The question you ask is what about the patient himself? And the answer to that is probably nothing. Because what we're talking about here is 24 hours versus 1 hour. But there's no question that if you want to recover an organ, even if it's a kidney, and out in an ideal physiological state. But of course, the sooner you can remove it from every circumstance, particularly when the cardiovascular system is still functioning, the better chance you have of a successful transplantation in somebody else. So the argument in the force that's being applied here, the primary organ transplantation, and therefore determined not by the patient death, but by somebody else.
I think we need to
you must really only provide it with a respiratory support system and a pharmacological system by which exogenous catecholamines are provided. With those two simple means, you can have an animal which has a wonderful set of lungs, a wonderful heart, excellent pancreas, will have all sorts of urine production. So, this is what we call the non-nervous system panel. You can remove one of the animals, the thyroid, and the pancreas, so you eliminate the pancreas for a little. Later on, I'm going to do
that. So, in that pancreas, the reason you were saying that I was looking at this for the event of keeping all the other organs in the pancreas, and then out of figure. And you see what happens, because you can talk to 24 hours.
This is true, but unfortunately, as I mentioned, the capability of bioengineering at the present time simply can't provide us with the same excellence for replication. It will be funded, but at the present time, this is not the truth. However, it does be something more than just concerned. Or otherwise, it's just concerned. You think more and more of a major problem. A lot of this is given more to indicate that the standing of the height and length is in a chemical way a handmade definition by something known as a chemical. But bioengineering is growing so rapidly, even though the artificial heart is still not with it, that there is no argument, I think, that can be made, at least scientifically, that eventually all organ function can be replicated in a time of time, not just over a short term only. So this can be done. As a matter of fact, liver, which, as you know, now is transplanted, kidney, is quite sensitive to oxygen deprivation. Now, what they do in some centers is just exactly what you're saying. I mean, what they do is when something goes through the sauna, they measure the definition of brain. And then they put the patient on an extracorporeal cardiopulmonary bypass, just as if they're going to do open heart. And under these circumstances, we immediately improve the circulation. And its whole performance as well as blood oxygenation. And so under these circumstances, in the sense of what the man dies, they turn that around and they put him on a support system, and they very carefully do not go back and place the electroencephalogram, because they may be surprised to find that the electroencephalogram is no longer found. So you see, as soon as you eliminate that 24-hour period, you're in real trouble in terms of being absolutely sure that things are your high three, that is, you can overcome them. You know, as I mentioned, we have seen patients whose brain has been literally destroyed. And for the next day or two following their surgical exploration, you can demonstrate spinal reflexes and your EEG is not found. But the matter of fact, when you take the brain out of an animal, and if you hook it up to a completely mechanical system, and such as the heart, lung, and kidney, as well as such the function, and then you put electrodes in the brain and on the surface, and you have a beautiful electroencephalogram for all of them. And now you have the only remaining biological tissue in your system is monkey blood. Everything else has been replicated at the tumor. And if you want to leave an eye,
yeah,
and put it in a large tumor, as you go to the you can recall off the visual cortex circuit. You're essentially not in the sun. In fact, if you leave in the external organs of the ear, then you're in the dark. You can tell that the auditory cortex. So that while this doesn't change necessarily, that this brain sees and hears, it means that all of the neural anatomical connections are passed and successfully deployed in, that is, the work approach of the brain in the appropriate area of cortex. Now, if that doesn't matter, they would hesitate to make any of these experiments to you. But if you take a monkey that keeps training for say a year or two, we probably eat like 2 or 3 months.
That is the best that Dr. Green and Dr. Theology would be.
In such a way that they can respond to visual cues, they can remove, you can hear two animals, and you can exchange their heads. You put it in the animal, and then with several types of transfers, using microsurgery, you can transfer one head to one body that is able to do the initial engineering that you need. Now, if you treat these animals properly, now we already have what's absolutely incapable of moving any of the limbs in the body. And the new body serves only as a power pack to do the same thing that the tumor did for the isolated brain. These head waves, we call them cephalons, because sometimes head bodies. They're waves, they're fat, they're ions, they're assigned to auditory stimuli, then they're, of course, near the facial muscles, they're tubes, they're attempting to eat. And
through a proper testing sequence, so I don't understand the development of my own experimental psychologist, we can actually demonstrate that these animals have a high capability of returning their tiny sequences given during the previous year, and they may judge that these animals are as mentally alert and as cognitive as they were when they were in the head dogs and they were when they were across the ground body.
It's an exciting pleasure, privilege, to be with you this morning. Psychoanalysts are people who, by virtue of their profession and for the sake of their patients, generally surround their lives with at least a degree of anonymity. And in their profession, they rarely have occasion to tell someone what they think, and how they feel, and where to get off. Our job is 98% listening, with the notion that when we do speak, we have heard and know what to speak to. And so, an occasion to speak out without having first listened is exciting and enjoyable. This paper is divided roughly into three parts. First part is a little wide of the mouth. But I want to take some gentle but meant criticism of the technological replacement of personal responsibility and personal dealing that I believe is creeping in to the medical field at an alarming rate. The second part of the paper is something of a review of the psychological and perhaps the physical science, the history of physical medicine, which accounts for the usual, quote unquote, medical attitude toward the dying person. The last part of the paper is my declaration of what I believe the human being can do with the experience of death. And I would go as far as to say my feeling of what the human being was meant to do. The quiet, honorable battle which has existed for years between clergymen and doctors in the matter of dying is about to be resolved. The clergymen are losing, but not to their respected and time-honored opponents. The new combatant on the field frequently wears a long white coat, but he probably has never given a pill, listening to a fetal heartbeat or wield this to fall. By the same token, he has never preached a sermon or celebrated mass. This new entrant into the arena of death may never have borne the responsibility of saving a life or of bringing salvation to a soul. And so it is no wonder that he is full of wondrous new observations and clear solutions. He's never known how lonely it feels to lose a teenage patient to leukemia, and he knows just as little about the satisfaction of successful coronary artery surgery that may give 30 years of full living to an otherwise dying young man. He may be aware that he is not, resistant to these medical experiences, but usually he is quite unaware that there is another side to dying to which he's equally uninitiated. He's never seen an old man make his final communion and give up the ghost with a smile 10 days before his heart stopped beating. And he's never stayed awake night struggling with the question, how do you comfort a 35-year-old woman who has just lost the baby for which she has prayed? Our new expert goes by many titles. But his distinguishing characteristic is not his mastery of an established and respected scientific discipline. His distinguishing characteristic is the naive certainty with which he announces his new solution to the oldest mystery of mankind. To him, the joy and agony of human death are defects in existence to be corrected by time and motion studies made on the medical personnel involved. The sum of his findings is entitled, quote, handling. determinal patient, unquote. The essence of his idea is, quote, give the dying patient some time to communicate, and he will give you lots less trouble, unquote. It is a sophisticated translation of a sociological fact which motivates management to, quote, give a company picnic. It is the same irresponsible naivete which prompts some experts to tell the psychological injured and dying among us, I'm okay, you're okay. Pleasant chats with dying patients do bring relief. It is the relief of distraction. The patients are indeed less troubled when the doctor is attentive. They are less troubled because having gotten a sympathetic word from the doctor on their intractable pain, their loss of appetite, or their petty annoyances, they are too guilty to talk about the real burden of their mind, so they gladly settle for you're okay. Certainly, I have not said these things to suggest that physicians do not need help in understanding the needs of the dying patient. As a physician, I am painfully aware of a tendency among my colleagues to psychologically abandon the dying patient. It is true that abandonment is, on occasion, an expression of a particular doctor's sense of failure or frustration, or perhaps even his anger. By and large, the doctor's relative lack of attention to the medical needs of the patient, who is irreversibly dying, is a matter of well-founded tradition. It is a tradition in the sense that the doctor has always felt that his first concern is to the living. His obligation to the dying is to, quote, keep him comfortable, unquote. The modern physician's preoccupation with the living may seem cold, but I would remind you that the time is gone when physicians have hours of time to spend on physically futile tasks. Heartwarming as is the picture of a country doctor waiting by lamplight at the side of a dying child, the fact of modern life suggests strongly that there are better ways for the physician to spend his 70-hour work week. The simple truth is that yesterday's kind, sympathetic doctor rarely had anything better to do than offer his support to the vast numbers of people he could not cure. The idea that there are better ways to spend professional time than in the needs of the dying is not a mere matter of disinterest. In spite of the tensions a few doctors have for material ostentation and regular hours, the majority are still sacrificing dedicated individuals who genuinely care about their patients. The tradition that one should let the dead bury the dead, that one's primary concern is with the living, is based on an old and accepted medical observation. It has long been observed by doctors that contrary to the way people die in novels, plays, and hellfire sermons, in actuality, most people simply fade away. The observation has never been made more clearly by a greater clinician or a more compassionate doctor than Sir William Osler. In his lecture on science and immortality, he writes, I have careful records of about 500 deathbeds, studied particularly with reference to the modes of death and the sensations of the dying. The latter alone concerns us here. 90 suffered bodily pain or distress of one sort or another, 11 showed mental apprehension, 2 positive terror, 1 expressed spiritual exaltation, and 1 bitter remorse. The great majority gave no sign one way or the other. Like their birth was asleep and forgetting. The teacher was right. In this matter, man has no preeminence over the beast. As the one dies, so dies the other. Unquote. Since the actual act of dying appears to be an almost inconsequential matter to most people, it is easy and natural for doctors to assume that the patient's best and only interest is the same as the doctor's, that is, living. It is easy to assume that people do not struggle or reflect or even want to know about their impending death because they, like the doctor, see nothing to struggle about once physical death is a mere certainty. As one physician said to me, look, the people I see die are so sick They are simply relieved to have it over with. If I am correct in thinking that the relative inattention paid to the psychological requirements of a dying patient is not a simple matter of mishandling to be remedied by employing more efficient modes of quieting people's apprehension, if I am correct in suggesting that the psychological care given to dying is largely based on the accepted observation that left to themselves, people naturally die quietly and inconsequentially, if I am right in these things, it seems that there is nothing to be gained by a prolonged discussion of the matter. Since, however, doctors are as uncomfortable about death and dying as our theologians, not to mention the growing army of professionals dedicated to the perfection of better ways to give people a feeling of worth, a feeling of love, a sense of well-being, and whatever else their potpourri philosophies of the deathbed see fit to dish out, since all concerned are troubled, it is entirely appropriate to re-examine the observations upon which the medical attitude toward the dying has been based. The absence of a psychology of dying in medical practice is the more obvious, since most of the medical world has long recognized the enormous part psychological factors play in the creation and cure of human illness. The entire field of psychosomatic medicine is an outgrowth of the wedding of psychoanalytic psychology with physiology, neurology, endocrinology, and many other fields. The application of Freudian psychology to physical processes ranges from understanding changes in the particular organs of the body in terms of a psychologically determined early stimulation and hyperfunction, to the symbolic use of an organ or bodily function to gain a psychological end. On the subject of physical death, however, Freud's thinking does not show this range of application. On this subject, he remains close to his original and continuing work to find a measurable physical basis for psychology. Thus, Freud involved the treatment of the subject of death in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, written in 1920, is reminiscent of his project for scientific psychology, written in 1885. The project for scientific psychology, that is, was an overambitious work to which Freud passionately devoted himself before he abandoned it unpublished. In it, he sought to explain psychological phenomena in terms of measurable quantities of energy acting in various ways within the cells of the nervous system. In every psychological field other than death, Freud liberated himself from the organic frame of reference. He did not give up the notion that ultimately there was a physical basis for psychic processes. But in fields other than death, he energetically embraced psychological terms and concepts as the most productive of useful theories. In Beyond the Pleasure Principle, Freud drew heavily upon the sciences of biology and physics of his day to support the idea that the endless, unpleasurable repetitions of memories, ideas, and feelings which he observed in certain neurotic processes were due to the operation of a, quote, death instinct, unquote. Freud assumed that the psychological compulsion to repeat was simply a manifestation of the elemental biological urge to repeat characteristic of basic instinctual life. Having observed the compulsion to repeat in persons who have suffered a traumatic loss, Freud reasoned that the motive for repetition was the restoration of an earlier, more stable state of existence. For example, a child who has lost a parent, he is compelled to repeat dreams which recall the presence of the parent. Freud now concluded, not too convincingly, that the aim of the underlying instinct was also the restoration of an earlier state. Thus it was logical, if not accurate, for him to conclude that the aim of the instinctual life is death, that is, inorganic stability. Certainly there is very little in these classical observations to warrant a different attitude toward death on the part of the modern physician. If life is merely an involved way of approaching death, If our most creative thoughts and acts are only sophisticated evidences of the human animal's inexorable movement toward exhaustion and the grave, then it is entirely appropriate to leave the dying undisturbed by religious hope or psychotherapeutic inventions. All talk aside, this is precisely what most often happens. There is, however, one practical advantage to Freud's theoretical position on death. The death instinct theory reestablishes death as a natural phenomenon rather than an artificial catastrophe. This may appear to be an unnecessary effort to elucidate an already evident fact. But a moment's reflection bears out the notion that modern man does not view death as a natural phenomenon. For example, death portrayed as an enemy is the best basis for fungi to conquer killer diseases. The funeral rite has become an elaborate means by which the reality and naturalness of death is denied. Perhaps the most influential force supporting modern man's unreal view of death is the popular interpretation of the future eschatology of the Christian faith. From this frame of reference, death may be denied as a real and present law. Logically, if not practically, mourning is an evidence of faithlessness. It is unfortunate that Freud's theory on death is his least clinical. The idea that man is instinctually driven toward his own demise is no more difficult to accept than the existence of infantile sexuality. However, because the latter theory is so completely founded in clinical fact, the original opposition to it has long since given way to revolutionary changes in man's thinking on childhood, education, and other things. No such change followed Freud's death instinct theory. I believe this is because it always remained an intellectual tour de force and never gained the solid base of clinical observation so typical of Freud's other theories. Ironically, in the minds of many thinkers, Freud's sonopology appears so inapplicable that it seems to join forces with Christianity's reified afterlife in robbing man of a realization of death and thereby making investigations into death pointless. Any theory or dogma which deprives man of the knowledge of his death as a natural aspect of living closes the door to an understanding of death except in a strict biologic sense. Our stumbling, uneasy work with the clinical facts of death and dying can be altered only as we investigate the subject as it is lived through by a person whose full knowledge of their situation transforms these esoteric subjects into living experiences. In her book on death and dying, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has done just this. She has not only questioned old observations, she has applied herself to making new observations. And she has done it in a thoroughly medical way. That is, she has worked with her patients. As a psychoanalyst, I find Dr. Ross's work exciting because she finds that patients who are informed of their impending death and who are offered an opportunity to participate in a thoroughly trustworthy and honest relationship become involved in a psychological process which progresses through distinct stages. The stages are characterized by a dominant emotion and or psychological defense. Dr. Ross recognizes five stages. Number one is denial. This is the time, for example, when people look for another doctor or for a bigger and more prestigious clinic. The second stage is anger, a time of raging over the apparent injustice of death. The third stage is bargaining, and my religious listeners hardly need an explanation of Dr. Ross's title for this stage of the psychological process of dying. It is a time in which patients promise God to live a better life if he will provide a miracle. The fourth stage is depression. The inevitability of loss is finally comprehended and gradually dealt with. The sense of loss begins with peripheral things and proceeds to loved ones and finally to the self. The fifth stage is acceptance. that the world should be at this time, there is neither depression or anger. The patient is resigned to his fate. The patient has accepted loss and needs only to be released from the hoping and concern of the family in order to achieve a death of serenity and dignity. There are several important features of this work which are germane to our purposes. The people with whom Dr. Ross worked were not especially equipped psychologically or intellectually for the horrendous task of dying. They were ordinary people confronted by life's most ordinary situations. There is no reason to believe that the professional relationship offered these patients was psychiatric in nature, beyond the fact that the doctor involved knew the truth and was willing to speak to the truth as the patient seemed ready for it. Even though the patients came to recognize and deal with facts which they had avoided, expert interpretations of unconscious material played little or no part in the interview. Hence, I believe we are safe in assuming that the psychological process which evolved was entirely natural. Nothing was superimposed on the patient. He was not urged to become involved. He was not pushed toward any particular conclusion. This is a familiar frame of reference for psychoanalysts because psychoanalysis, too, aims at the establishment, or should I say the re-establishment, of natural mental processes. In distinction from therapies which aim at producing particular results, psychoanalysis aims only at dissolving the mental barriers to growth which fear has spawned. The psychological growth which results in psychoanalysis differs in no essential way from growth outside of treatment. Hence, since the psychoanalytic description of growth is indeed a description of a natural process, it need not be limited to psychoanalytic patients. Psychoanalysis is a dramatic example of growth. It is dramatic only because the patient has been used and painfully restrained from growing. The undoing of the fear, guilt, and shame which afforded the natural process of growth engenders intense conflict, which in turn precipitates movement. However, even this drama and intensity is not entirely peculiar to psychoanalysis. I believe this is essentially the same process that Dr. Ross described. The equanimity which her patients achieved was a consequence of growth precipitated by impending death. The thesis of this paper is that death is simply a special example of many situations common to human life which offer people an unusual opportunity for growth. It is my conviction that the aura of denial and false hopefulness which we impose on the deathbed is only the converse of the aura of tragedy and gloom which so often surrounds the deathbed. Both are entirely artificial, defensive phenomenon aimed at preserving the comfortable but stunting infantile illusions which undergird so much of modern existence. The fear of death is simply the fear of growing. However strange that may sound to the layman, it is familiar as well as sensible to the analyst. Every successful analytic patient has cried out more than once, "You're killing me. You're taking away everything worthwhile in life." This the patient proclaims when in fact the analyst only seeks to lay bare the unfulfillable infantile wishes and the painful fears of childhood that are disguised by the patient's debilitating psychological symptoms. The bitterness and fear which characterize the early stages of dying are often expressed with the same language patients use when they are introduced to growth, because both processes involve personal loss. Hence, a patient in the phrase of analysis describes his excruciating responses to the analytic interpretation as an agonizing death of hope. Another patient consistently associated the analytic process with a boyhood desire to live so close to the seashore that he would be constantly drenched by the spray of the waves and the rocks. The work of analysis seemed to call him away from the moist freshness of the sea toward the hot, dry city, where he felt that everything beautiful and alive in him would die. A patient finishing her analysis dreamed of walking to a graveyard. Suddenly, she had the urge to dig up several graves which seemed to contain cherished parts of her own childhood. As she looked around for a shovel, she thought, "What a waste of time." And accordingly, she moved on to a busy city. Growth is painful because it involves an awareness of death and loss. Physical death itself is perfectly easy to get through, given false hope and false reassurance from friends, clergymen, and doctors in matters of unimportance, and unyielding silence in matters of consequence. Most patients can glide untroubled into a state of physical deterioration in which they may remain as refractory to the fact of death as they have been to the fact of life. At this point, all concerned may relax because there is nothing more to fear. There is only death. All that is left is physical death, which for most people is only an outward manifestation of an inward condition which has characterized their life. Dr. Osgood is correct. To most people, death is a sleep and a forgetting. Death of this kind is not frightening. There is no real experience of loss. Death like this is a comfort. In this respect, most people spend their lives dying because it is so easy relative to living and growing. Death, as it is usually experienced, is not frightening. It is the inescapably personal opportunity for growth, which death thrusts upon one, that is terrifying, because growth does involve loss. It is the pain of intimate loss, inseparably associated with growth, which doctors, clergymen, and patients alike seek to avoid. Any experience that has dynamic growth potential involves some real dying, that is, a process of it involving an affirmation of loss. Approaching physical death is life's greatest single opportunity for utterly personal growth, because it is an utterly personal loss. But here it is important to remember that I'm speaking of growth as a process. Growth and death is not a matter of heroic surrender to the grave any more than it is a matter of stoic reflection and resignation. As I hope to describe later, faith may provide a creative context in which growth can occur, but does not exist, particularly when it includes an unquestioned expectation of heavenly reward in exchange for moral behavior, is a hindrance to growth via death. The common man's Christian faith rarely prepares him for growth in good health, and so it is no wonder that he finds his death just one more frightening opportunity to be avoided. And that, I think, I better have a drink of water. Growth is not only a matter of emotional insight or intellectual formulation. It is a process. It is a natural process, and that makes it transcendent to the efforts of the individual. Growth involves stages of progress which cannot be circumvented, even if one has the intellectual capacity to see beyond them, if the result is to be genuine. Growth is a common process available to all men who are offered circumstances which arise in awareness of themselves and a trustworthy, lasting, and honest relationship with someone who can stand to be loved, hated, rejected, and depended upon while he assists in the birth of new life. An understanding of the birth process is so centrally important to a wholesome, creative view of death that I would like to illustrate it. It would be easy to draw upon psychoanalytic case material, but since growth is a common natural process, we can just as easily examine it in non-analytic circumstances. With this in mind, let us look at the relationship which the Apostle Peter had with Christ. In doing so, it is important that the religious listener be aware that I am not suggesting that Peter's relationship with Christ involved nothing more than psychological growth. Obviously, it involved a great deal more. But in developing the notion of death as an opportunity for growth, I wish to emphasize the natural growth process. To exemplify the growth process in the life of Peter, I invite you to consider his life with Christ as a series of encounters which threaten to reveal infantile aspects of himself which had to be given up, allowed to die in the course of his following Christ. I remind you that this giving up was and still is experienced as a death. According to the Apostle Luke, Peter's first response to the revealing nature of Christ's concern was to fall down and declare himself a sinful man. Strangely, Christ did not speak to his sin, but spoke to his fear. Parenthetically, it is important at this point to give passing attention to a form critic's claim that the passage may be an amalgamation of several smaller pieces and doesn't yield to an interpretation of the whole. I suggest that Christ did not speak to Peter's sins because they were only a defense, a comfortable distraction away from the truth which Peter feared to see. Nevertheless, Christ offered Peter a relationship that was to lead him away from catching fish to catching men. Peter's affirmation of Christ after the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida turned out to be not an affirmation of Christ, but of the messianic figure Peter wanted Christ to be. Of course, the Messiah Peter wished Christ to be would have been no threat to Peter. No secret truth would have to emerge. The psychological regression which Christ talked of suffering induced in the apostles brought out the childish bravado in Peter, not to mention the boyish presumptuousness of James and John. In the garden, Peter responded to Christ's desperate situation with reassuring nonsense, quote, "Even though we all fall away, I will not," unquote. Then, like the child he was, he lay down and went sound asleep. But in Pilate's courtyard, Peter saw himself for what he was. Like a brave boy, he had followed his beloved hero all the way to Jerusalem. But now it was time for Christ to die, and time for Peter to experience the death of the naive, appealing youth which he had so carefully avoided seeing throughout his relationship with Christ. Peter lost Christ, as he had known him, at the crucifixion. But Peter lost himself, as he had known himself, when he betrayed Christ in Pilate's courtyard. Peter wept and mourned his loss. Irrespective of the several occasions in which he experienced the post-resurrectional presence of Christ, he could not regain his lost esteem in his boyish self. That was dead, and Peter mourned it. I suggest that the joy of Pentecost is the result of an accomplished mourning process. I suggest that in mourning, Peter gave up a precious part of himself and then realized that in giving up something, he himself had changed. On the day of Pentecost, Peter looked at his brothers and realized that through his own suffering and loss, he now was able to see them with the same kind of compassion and love Christ had expressed. Peter resisted awareness, he mourned loss, and the death of a part of himself, but in so doing, he experienced the joy of change. I believe that these highlights of the life of Peter demonstrate that the enormous change which took place in his life can be accounted for in terms of what we now know to be a natural growth process. Because it is the natural result of truth revealed within the context of an honest relationship based on fact, the growth process has certain predictable features. Growth is characterized by a persistent resistance to the unfolding of its various stages. Growth that is manifested in qualitative, lasting change is not the proud accomplishment of a private intellectual exercise, any more than it is the product of overwrought emotion and spiritual ecstasy. Intellectual involvement is necessary. Emotional expression is essential. But the psychological death of the illusions, loves, and hates of childhood proceeds at its own slow pace, and even that is resisted. Hence, Peter resisted Christ and the moving relationship he offered by speaking in traditional terms about his sins when he was, in fact, scared out of his mind. Eventually, Peter gave up his protective talk about sins and took a step closer to the truth. At Caesarea Philippi, Peter opened himself to truth a little more, but kept himself protected with fanciful expectations for Christ's messiahship. Christ's same presentation of suffering sent Peter reeling into the most common and effective of all resistances to grace, that is, rejection. Finally, at his denial of Christ, Peter gave up rejection and faced the bitter truth about himself, the truth that Christ had threatened to expose at their first meeting. Now Peter was facing fact, but fact facing is not all there is to grace. It is only an important first part. The rest is essentially a mourning process. Each childish hope, each yearning for gratification, every wish that one might avoid fear and frustration and remain a beautiful child forever is gone over. Each one is raged over and cried over until it is finally let go, that is, allowed to die. In his essay entitled Thoughts for the Times and War and Death, Freud says, if, that is, a realization of death, occurred when primeval man saw someone who belonged to him die, his wife, his child, his friend, whom he undoubtedly loved as we love ours, for love cannot be much younger than the lust to kill. Then in his pain, he was forced to learn that one can die oneself, and his whole being revolted against the admission. For each of these loved ones was, after all, a part of his own beloved self. Peter experienced the death of precisely that part of himself which he had mistakenly imputed to Christ, that is, his childish and presumptuous superiority to the context of men. It was the golden hope of childhood to which the knowledge of impending death always lays claim. Since our purpose in describing the birth process in such detail is to compare it with the death process, it is essential that we not confuse this letting go, this death of the mourned objects and objectives of childhood, with a sanctimonious notion of a loving sacrifice. Growth, whether in full health or in near death, has nothing to do with pious offering. Growth is a resisted, powerful response to truth within the context of a loving relationship, for example, the functional Christian community. It is a process larger than the individual. There is only one truly accurate analogy to the birth process, and that is the one Christ used, that is, birth. I have chosen to exemplify the birth process with the life of Peter, not just because I'm speaking to a theologically oriented audience, but also because Peter's growth included a stage which goes beyond the serene acceptance of loss. The final result of Peter's despairing and mourning of his loss of a vaunted picture of himself was not resigned acceptance of a dull fate. It was joy. The joy of knowing that in loss and in the mourning of loss, he had been personally transformed. Analysts have long recognized that loss, particularly a loss of an immature part of oneself, must be mourned, just as a loved one is mourned at death. They also recognize that when the work of mourning is accomplished and the loss is an accepted fact, there is a bursting release of the present energies which have been attached to the infantile object. The result is new energy which may emerge upon one as joy. Joy that bursts forth from a realization of sin, wrought in loss and mourning, is so strange to modern man that he mistakes it for the silly happiness of possession and accomplishment. Hence he must understand even its basic features. One of the most interesting characteristics of joy is that it drives one to share, to become fused through the shared experience of the emotion with the world around one. Emotionally speaking, this fusion is accomplished because joy, which is the result of personal transformation, also gives one a profound and appropriate sense of the relative insignificance of one's personal existence. Joy which evolves through a process of natural growth is essentially sexual in nature, in that its fullest expression occurs at the moment the self is lost. As any well-bedded couple knows, The use of syntactically correct and precise language garbles the expression of joy. The only language appropriate to joy is the language of love and of eternity. Unhappily, this is merely a dead language to 20th century man, and so he mistakes its truth for poetic life. So far as being joyful is concerned, the great limitation of modern man is that he holds back from that which he knows to be true, which he cannot be validated by the instruments currently employed by science. Of course, it is precisely this resistance to blind belief that has moved man away from magic and superstition towards knowledge and rationale. But it also often deprives man of a realization of his most basic nature. Hence, man is only reasonable when he turns away from the infantile notion of eternal life doled out in response to man's puny effort to live a good life. But one of the tragedies of modern man is that he also turns away from the joyous knowing that he is eternal, which naturally results from the final and utterly complete loss of oneself occasioned by death. Eternal life, as a mode of existence, verifiable by the procedures of science, continues to elude man. But it is a verifiable fact that when men and women die within the context of a loving, honest relationship that has turned hoping, disillusionment, despair, and mourning into new stages in the process of growing, death can be experienced as an eschatologic loss of oneself that occasions joy. It is joy to be expressed in the words of Paul with sighs too deep for words. Such an event is beyond sacrifice and bargain, heroic confessions and humble resignation, because it is the natural result of a natural process which transcends the individual. In growth, the individual is transcended, but not excluded. The capacity of the individual for decision is not rendered inoperative by the process. But decision cannot change the process. It only changes the individual's participation in it. For example, Peter could decide to follow or stay. Having chosen to follow at a psychological distance, he was free to see the truth or circumvent the truth. But each time the truth was faced, he was carried along to a new stage of development where once again he had choices open to him. Of course, decisions are never made in complete freedom. But relative to the random movement of unchanging people, growing people are quite free to make decisions which affect in an essential way their participation in the growth process. The notion of death as a decision, as it applies to the experience of death, is the major concern of Ladislav Boris S.J. in his book, Mysterium Mortis, The Mystery of Death. I've got some time talking to theologians about it for a little Latin. In summary, he says, death is man's first completely personal act, and is therefore, by reason of its very being, the center above all for the awakening of consciousness, for freedom, for the encounter with God, for the final decision about one's eternal destiny. Speaking of the resurrection of Christ, Boris draws from the Apostle Paul in Romans 6:5 and Ephesians 4:15, when he says, if, that is the resurrection, secures the condition for the possibility of our salvation, because it enables us to grow together with the risen body of Christ, and this growing together with Christ is precisely what salvation is. Clearly, Boris sees the death experience as an opportunity for growth, which is unsurpassed by any other event, because it is the most exquisitely personal moment of anyone's temporal experience. The decision open to man is death in death is to affirm or to deny. That death is beyond righteousness, retribution, and even understanding. When all of these things are given up, then death is man's first and last chance to embrace the utter humanness of his condition. But by the same token, It is his first and last chance that to know that in choosing to affirm the complete loss demanded by death, there is transformation toward man's prototype of God made man, and there is also the joy of transformation. It is the passionate joy of gaining and loss, that which is lost in gain. Men and women who have tried to express it are maligned by interpreters who take their words for concrete proof of the corporeal existence of their favorite fantasies about heaven and hell. Physical debility, the utter privacy of the event, and the nature of joy itself make accurate interpretation of a joyful man's dying expression impossible to interpret. It is an experience to be understood in sharing. It is in sharing our brother's death that we are assured that when a man mourns and affirms the final loss of his lifetime, he can know in abundance the joy which follows the thousand deaths that accompany everyday living.